Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And this is Spy Talk. Well, another week in which DNI, Tulsi Gabbard, inserted herself into a national political question. And we're going to get to that in a second. But first of all, we have a little housekeeping. It involves a recent report we did about the new JFK assassination documents that seem to implicate the CIA and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Mike, what's that all about?
It was such nonsense. But, I think we were both stunned when we picked up the Washington Post last week and saw on the front page a story suggesting that these new JFK assassination docs show a connection between the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone gunman who killed the president from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building. And the story on the front page said these new documents raise further questions about the CIA's awareness and or involvement in the plot to murder the president. And we wrote a story calling attention to those like completely groundless words. There's absolutely no evidence of the CIA's involvement in
as much as we would like to have that.
Hey, listen, there've been many investigations and investigators who have hoped to find more of a CIA role,
could
but
be
it
another
just
Oliver.
Simply isn't there. Anyway, we called it to the attention of the Washington. Oh, I forgot. Then, after we wrote the story, we discover that that language about the CIA's involvement in the murder of the president had been removed on the online version. They had taken it out with no notice to the readers.
Stealth removal.
Yeah. Stealth edit. We called it to the attention of the standards editor of the Washington Post. She got right on it. And in fact, the Washington Post has now run a correction, removing the language and retracting the language about the CIA's involvement. CIA did a lot of nasty shit during that period, we all know, including trying to assassinate Castro and doing all sorts of other things to undermine the Cuban economy at the direction of the president, by the way, John F. Kennedy being among them. Killing the president was just one of them.
You can imagine Oliver Stone just licking his chops.
Yeah.
Another JFK movie based on. I interviewed Oliver Stone.
Did you?
Back in the, this is the 1990s, after the JFK, his infamous, legendary, quite gripping, but totally baloney movie about the Kennedy assassination came out, or JFK. Right. And I was thinking of doing a book about politics and the media. And I was going to use JFK and Oliver Stone as kind of my thread for the whole story. And when I went out to Stone's office, he asked me what I thought about the movie, and I hedged and I said, well, I think it's great to get people really interested in American politics and history. And I think the movies got everyone talking. So you really accomplished that. He looked at me and he said, we had documents for everything on that movie. And I thought, well, yeah, you can have documents to show you anything, especially if they come from a crackpot prosecutor.
I know.
In New Orleans. So he had documented.
Glorified this crackpot, James Garrison, who brought a case that was tossed out of court within an hour or so. Yeah. I mean, just completely ridiculous.
Anyway, we're going to be writing more about the Washington Post. Very lame correction, I must say. Yeah. Very anodyne, let's say. I think people would have to read it three times to see what the big change is. Because they haven't really taken back a lot of assertions they made in their story, in their unvetted story. Really extraordinary. First of all, it shows how old we are, Mike. We're still getting the print edition of the Washington Post. Yeah. But it's startling still to us to see a front page story that's so really scandalous that they would print such an unvetted story. Anyway, yeah. So you'll see that in your email box pretty soon, maybe even later today, about the Washington Post correction. But we got to go and talk yet again about Tulsi Gabbard. You know, most DNIs are seen but not heard much.
Yeah.
You know, they testify every once in a while before Congress, but they generally, you know, keep to the business of coordinating the work of the United States intelligence community, some 1670, I don't know what it is now, agencies. And but Tulsi Gabbard managed to insert herself in these past scandals about Russian interference in the 2016. We're still talking about the 2016 elections. Take it away, Mike.
Yeah. I mean, what she put out was so over the top. The release of the documents is fine. We're all for, you know, let's see as much as we can. We're for that. There was some, you know, for aficionados of this, there were some interesting details in the actual material she got declassified, but none of it remotely added up to the spin she put on this, that this was evidence of a treasonous conspiracy led by Barack Obama to undermine Trump's presidency. There's nothing in the documents that show that. In fact, the fundamental, this was all about what got put into the January 2017 intelligence assessment that concluded that the Russians had launched this unprecedented campaign to interfere in our politics, stealing emails, dumping them through WikiLeaks, social media ads secretly put on Facebook, Twitter, all of the stuff we've written and talked about for years. None of that is undercut by anything that Tulsi Gabbard.
It just seems like more sand in our eyes, you know.
And the idea that treason, as though, look, we were both there at the time. We were covering this. We knew what was in the heads of people, and there were legitimate concerns about A, what the Russians were doing, and about multiple connections to the Trump campaign, and indeed Trump himself, who had been to Moscow, who had said favorable things about Vladimir Putin. And then here's Vladimir Putin's intelligence services doing as much as they can to denigrate his opponent, Hillary Clinton, in the election. How you get from legitimate concerns about that to a treasonous conspiracy is
involving
President Obama is just absurd.
You know, it just seems sand in the eyes because it comes out right in the middle of the Epstein scandal.
Right.
It's remarkable that Tulsi Gabbard has people on her staff who will gin up this kind of phony analysis of the FBI's investigation, so on and so forth, and the Russians, and right at the time of the Epstein thing. And Tulsi Gabbard was in Trump's doghouse only a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, because Trump his exact quote is, "I don't care what she has to say," right?
And she's making videos about nuclear war and the warmongers and
So this was clearly an attempt to curry favor with El Presidente, who was getting cool to her service as DNI. So she's trying to keep her job by pleasing and throwing out just like ridiculous allegations.
But, you know, this whole 2016 elections and Russians and so forth still has ramifications going on as we speak. And our guest today is going to address that is Michael Feinberg, who's a senior FBI agent who was forced to resign from his position as a counterintelligence agent in the Norfolk office. He had spent a lot of his 15-year career chasing Chinese spies. But it was his friendship with Peter Strzok, the kind of controversial former FBI agent involved in the Crossfire Hurricane investigation of Russian influence here, that got him fired. And he's coming on our show today to talk about it.
Well, it'll be really interesting to hear what he has to say. And I'm in particular interested and want to hear about the idea that not only was he informed that his relationship with Strzok was going to get in the way of any promotion at the FBI, he was going to be polygraphed about his friendship and relationship with a fellow agent. And, you know, I understand that there are legitimate uses for polygraphs at times, but boy, that seems like stretch
to coin,
a purpose like that.
To coin a phrase, it's a witch hunt.
Okay.
So without further ado, let's bring Michael Feinberg on. Michael Feinberg, welcome to Spy Talk. Take us to that moment when the head of your office, Dominique Evans, came to you and told you that you were in big trouble because of your friendship with Pete Strzok, who was on the enemies list of Kash Patel, the FBI director.
So it wasn't an in-person conversation. She was actually on a cruise in Europe at the time, but she reached out to me by phone on a Saturday morning while I was actually at the office to inform me that it had come to the deputy director, Dan Bongino's attention that I was friends with Pete Strzok and remained in contact with him after he was fired from the bureau. There were a number of conversations that I subsequently had with Dominique throughout the course of the day. And at the final one, after I'd sort of regained my self-composure and an ability to think analytically, because it had been a tumultuous day because it was very clear that my life professionally and personally as I knew it was over in some form or fashion. But when I had gotten to the point where I could sort of clearly analyze the situation and pose the questions I needed to, during one of our later phone calls, I just explicitly asked her, you know, maybe you can't tell me because you don't want to, or you don't know, or maybe you're a little wary of telling me, but what is on the table for me? What am I looking at here? And that's when she informed me that I would not be getting any of the promotions for which I was currently being considered. I would probably be demoted from a leadership position within the organization. And at the very least, I could be expected to be subject to polygraphs in Washington, D.C., probing the nature of my friendship with Pete, whatever that means.
Michael, just so we are clear on the players and where everybody stands at this point, Dominique Evans is the SAC, special agent in charge of the Norfolk office. What was your position at the Norfolk office at the time?
I was in the Norfolk office for about 18 months as the assistant special agent in charge, which is one of the number two positions in the field office, over all the national security and intelligence programs.
And how long had you been with the Bureau?
About 16 or 17 years.
16 years. So yeah. You're a veteran agent at this point. Before Norfolk, you'd worked in counterintelligence, and we'll get into this. That's where you met Peter Strzok. So you're being told after 16 years in the FBI that the new deputy director wants you polygraphed about your friendship with another FBI agent.
Correct.
That strikes one as a pretty extreme measure, and especially an extreme use of FBI polygraphs.
Yeah, there's actually quite a few issues with it. The baseline one for me is that you don't give up all of your First Amendment freedom of association rights when you join the Bureau. Had I been under scrutiny for a friendship with a foreign national or a member of the active media, I could understand questions about whether those relationships were proper. They both impact one's security clearance, for example. But this was an entirely social relationship with somebody who, in fact, was a former very high senior executive in the organization. And at the time Bongino became concerned, as it had been since Pete left the Bureau, our relationship consisted entirely of basically going to concerts and restaurants. There was no aspect of my FBI career which was implicated by the friendship. So that's issue number one. The second issue is polygraphs are a finite resource within the Bureau. There are only so many polygraphers, there are only so many hours in the day, and every time that one of those investigators is being told to dig into a personal relationship for the sake of some sort of ideological or political purity test, they're not being used on active investigations.
Did your supervisor express any regret for notifying you that you were essentially done?
No, not really. And it's funny because I tried to put myself in her shoes, both at the moment and as I've constantly replayed the conversations over the past 6 or 7 weeks. And what I keep coming back to is that I've been on the other side of this conversation. You know, between being an ASAC, a supervisor, a unit chief, I've had a lot of roles where I was in charge of other individuals in the Bureau and had to deliver bad news to them that they were not going to want to hear. No matter what they had done or what set of circumstances they were facing, though, there was always an effort on my part, and this may be my background as being one of the Bureau's employee assistance peers. There was always an effort to deliver the news with at least compassion and empathy and an attempt to offer some sort of support, however inadequate it might end up being to the issue at hand. I really got none of that from Dominique. This was a very matter-of-fact recitation, incredibly formalized, incredibly curt, that my career was over.
How did you come to be friends with Peter Strzok?
So he was somebody who had a very long history, well before he ever became famous or infamous, as somebody who had worked in the FBI's counterintelligence program for the better part of 2 decades. And when I arrived in DC, having spent about 6 years in Los Angeles as a field agent, I came to the counterintelligence division at headquarters, and it turned out we had a number of mutual acquaintances and friends. And over my first few months there, he got promoted to a position where he was in my direct chain of command. And we got to know each other and discovered that we had a lot of similar interests, and gradually a professional relationship became a personal one.
Now, he got into trouble because he was the lead agent, at least initially, on Crossfire Hurricane, the investigation into Donald Trump's potential or in his campaign's ties to Russia.
Yeah, I would gently push back against that characterization. An investigation like that is always it's a large team of individuals at all levels of investigative personnel, analytic personnel, and leadership and management.
Right.
And at that time, Pete was one of the senior executives overseeing the case.
He was a lead agent, and we should point out he was fired by the Bureau for cause because it was discovered by the Justice Department Inspector General that he had sent multiple texts to his fellow agent Lisa Page, with whom he was having a relationship, in which he disparaged the target of the investigation and expressed extremely biased views. In fact, there's one famous, infamous exchange in which Lisa Page says, how can we, you know, what happens if Trump would become president? And he responds, you know, that won't happen. We will stop it. And Michael Horowitz, the inspector general, said that although he couldn't find evidence that struck distorted his decision making, it showed, according to Horowitz, an intention to be willing to make judgments based on his personal preferences rather than the evidence. Did you discuss this, his firing, with Peter Strzok and your friends? You're going to concerts. Mm-hmm. How could you not have discussed this with him?
Discussed which aspect of it?
I mean, obviously, that he was fired by the FBI.
Yeah, of course. I mean, he was a friend, and it was a public record that he was fired. But you know, I'll point out, I never worked on any of the investigations which gave rise to the controversies in which the Bureau became mired during Chris Wray's tenure. And, you know, I didn't know about any of the details of them even while they were going on. My knowledge about those investigations never came from Pete or anybody working on them, but from reading the same IG report that you just referenced and seeing coverage in the newspapers. Pete's a controversial figure, and he made a lot of decisions that he himself would characterize as mistakes. But I honestly don't see what that had to do with my position in the FBI or why I should be sort of saddled with the fallout from those decisions, most of which were from nearly a decade ago on matters which I never worked on.
Circling to the present again, do you know of other, do you have other friends in counterintelligence who have been forced out of the Bureau because of their association with the Russia investigation?
I want to answer that very carefully, because a lot of Bureau personnel decisions, as they should be, are not made public or available to individuals other than those directly involved. I know of quite a few people who worked those investigations who have left before they originally intended to. Whether they were subtly forced out or whether they just read the writing on the wall and made a decision on their own to leave, I can't say. But I know that many of those investigators who are my cohort in terms of age and tenure within the organization are no longer with it.
Would you, could you put a figure on that, a number of agents who have left?
Probably not. I mean, in turn,
talking about a dozen, two dozen.
No, I think your first number would be closer, and it may even be less than that. But it's important to remember, investigations like that one are generally very closely held at the Bureau. And as a result, they try and limit the number of individuals involved. So I genuinely have no idea how many agents were involved in the early iteration of the Russia investigations before they went to Mueller. But because of the way the Bureau staffs these things and tries to minimize the number of individuals read in, I'd point out that even if, you know, the Bureau lost 3 to 6 people, that's still a pretty significant number given how many how few individuals were probably roped into it at the beginning.
Well, they've lost a lot more than that if we expand the universe from just the Russia investigation, but there's a lot of people across the board that have been either fired or pushed out or demoted and have left on their own. But what more broadly, what do you make of the way the Bureau is being run now by Kash Patel and Dan Bongino? It seems quite different than any other FBI leadership team we've ever seen.
No, I remarked in another interview a few weeks ago that what the FBI reminds me of now, as somebody who's worked counterintelligence for his whole career, is honestly what the KGB or its forerunner, the NKVD, would have looked like after one of the Politburo's ideological purges during the Cold War, or what China's MSS would have looked like after one of the pretextual corruption hunts that have gone on in that country over the past decade or so.
You're saying that this is a communist-style purge on political grounds?
I don't know how you could look at 20th century history and compare it to anything else. Individuals are being forced out or placed in positions, for lack of a less colloquial way of phrasing it, far from the action, simply because maybe they were appointed by Chris Wray. Maybe they worked on fully predicated and DOJ authorized investigations that rubbed the current administration the right way. In some cases, they were just friends or related to people who did things the administration didn't like. But there is a massive outflow and sidelining of subject matter expertise and operational experience from the Bureau over the past 6 months, and that's making us less safe.
I want to get back to that specific issue of subject matter experts like yourself, who was a subject matter expert on Chinese espionage in the United States. But before I want to tie up this thing about the purge going on. Probably Michael and I probably have nearly a century's combined experience covering the FBI. It is a conservative organization. Can you give us any estimate of the level of enthusiasm inside the Bureau for Trump and the MAGA regimen?
I'm reluctant to speak to individuals' political views when it comes to career politicians, simply because despite the slanders that individuals like Patel and Bongino put on us over the past 8 years or so, everybody I know in the FBI really made a fastidious effort to not talk about their personal political views. You know, one of the hallmarks of a contemporary nation state is that it has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force and investigative authorities in a society. And as part of that power, there's a responsibility to demonstrate to the American people that it's being wielded in an apolitical, nonpartisan fashion. And we're all acutely aware of that responsibility. And as a result, like talking about who we voted for president or where we stand on culture war issues, it just wasn't something that was really done. Now, when it comes to the workforce's opinion of Patel and Bongino as leaders and managers of the organization, that is something that gets discussed because, quite frankly, there's no workplace in the world where people don't talk about their bosses. And I can tell you, there are people who strongly disagree with a lot of what they're doing. There are people who agree with what they're doing. But I don't know anybody who really respects them as leaders.
There must have been, you know, again, I in my brief glorious experience as a case officer, in the Army in Vietnam. It was the same, you know. The war sucked, but we didn't talk about it.
Right.
But had someone like Cash Patel and Dan Bongino, who made careers attacking the FBI as part of the deep state. Just can you take us back to the moment when it was announced that they were being nominated to run the Bureau?
It was sheer incredulity. You know, Patel was nominated first, and he's somebody who wrote four books about how evil he believed DOJ and its component agencies were. Three of those books were fantasies for children, in which a wizard named Cash defeats an evil dragon named DOJ and sticks it on his own enemy. Like, these are not serious adults who have actually grappled with issues relating to rule of law and constitutional norms. Mm-hmm. They're partisan players. So when Cash was nominated, we weren't even sure he would get confirmed. But it became clear that the Senate was going to, and like, look, elections have consequences. We all get that. And he was going to be our director. But I think it was an early bellwether of what was headed our way when we were told he had promised that he would promote a career agent to the position of deputy director. This was announced to the entire workforce by the Agents Association. And less than 14 hours after that announcement, we found out that Bongino was going to be assuming the position. There is very little reason for the workforce to trust anything these two people tell us.
Did I read correctly that you had crossed paths with Cash Patel in your counterintelligence days?
Never.
No.
No,
you did not overlap with him.
No, I was in counterintelligence division management when I believe he was at the NSC, but our paths never crossed. We've never had a conversation. I am not, to my knowledge, I've never been in the same room as him.
Can we assume same goes with Bongino?
Yeah, and it's funny when my SAC reached out to me to express Bongino's displeasure. I offered to talk to him and explain the nature of my relationship with Pete and have a conversation about it. And Dominique, the SAC, told me there's basically no world in which that's ever going to be allowed to happen.
Did you consider taking a whistleblower position? That's to the uninitiated. That's
I did.
Officially allowed. It's established. It's been established for many decades now, that you can take a principled stand against management for actions you think are illegal.
Yes.
So why didn't you?
It's a bit of a complicated question. And while I'm loath to get into my personal life and affairs, I sort of need to explain that. When it became apparent what was going to be done to me, one of the first things I did was talk to an entire tranche of employment lawyers, both nationally known individuals at the white shoe firms and local practitioners who did nothing but the federal government. And we determined that I could fight it and I would probably win. But it would take years. And the government, as you both are probably well aware, can very much ruin your life if it wants to, in very subtle, non-legally actionable ways.
Could have sent you to Alaska.
Exactly. We signed mobility agreements. I could have been anywhere. And when I got that phone call from Dominique, my wife was 7 months into a high-risk pregnancy. Relocating to another area where we didn't have a medical support system and we're even farther from family than we currently are now, it wasn't an option. The bitter, angry, frustrated person fighting this would have turned me into is not who she needs during her last trimester. It is certainly not who my soon-to-be son is going to need during his first few years of life.
Sure.
And so fighting it in court wasn't really an option. In terms of being a whistleblower, I don't know that that's really a viable avenue for government employees anymore. Given the majorities in the Senate and the views of individuals who claim to champion whistleblowers, there is a marked tendency to discount anything that is said against this administration. Just look at how the immigration attorney from Maine Justice was treated after he made a whistleblower complaint. He was actually fired.
Pete Strzok, your friend Pete Strzok, successfully sued the department for essentially a wrongful dismissal.
Yeah,
I think it was wrongful dismissal, or was it violation of the privacy rights by missing the text messages?
Yeah, I'm not following his litigation particularly closely, but my understanding is I think he had two claims against the government, and one was settled nearly a decade after the suit was filed, and I think the other one is still ongoing. So even like if he saw some modicum of success in his efforts, like 8-10 years is a long time to wait that out.
Did you discuss what happened to you with Strzok?
After the fact, I did.
And tell us about that conversation and what his reaction was.
I'd assume he thinks it's pretty ludicrous, but when I told him, I called him to tell him I had resigned from the Bureau, and he asked me why, and I said, I'm willing to explain it to you, but I need you to promise me that we're not going to dwell on it, and you're not going to feel guilty about it or try and make any amends. So I haven't really talked. He knows I left. We've talked about that. I haven't really probed his feelings on being a part of that, because
but you did tell him the reason they gave you for why.
And look, I wrote an entire article about it for Lawfare. I don't think I've been secretive about the chain of events whatsoever.
And did he say, geez, whatever?
I'm sorry. Reality. I mean, what did he
really
say?
Sorry.
Of course he did. But like, look, he is a friend, and I didn't want to dwell on that part of the story any more than I wanted him dwelling on it. So I made it known that was why they were coming after me. That was why I resigned. And that was sort of it. It hasn't been like a topic of conversation that's lingered for the past 6 weeks.
Let's move on to the effect on counterintelligence. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to assume that Norfolk is a hotbed of, well, let me ask you,
Is it
safe to assume that Norfolk is a hotbed of Chinese espionage because it's the home of, for starters, it's the home of the Atlantic Fleet. SEAL headquarters and training grounds are not far away. I assume, given your specialty in Chinese espionage, that you were pursuing cases against Chinese spies or suspected Chinese spies in the Norfolk area. Those cases were dropped with your removal?
So I'm going to be very careful how I answer that question, because I still have ongoing obligations to protect certain types of information.
Sure.
When I take those obligations,
I'm talking about in general.
In general, I would just note that Norfolk has the highest concentration of military assets, bases, and personnel of any region in the entire world. It has NATO's North American headquarters. It has a number of specialty teams in the area, in the office's area of responsibility. It has a number of cleared defense contractors who manufacture weapons of war that are not manufactured by anything, by anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It is 100% a massive target for foreign intelligence services from a wide range of hostile nations. And the counterintelligence work there, as well as the counterterrorism work, is incredibly important to this nation's security.
So, do you think cases were dropped because of your dismissal or your forced retirement?
No, I don't think any cases were dropped. People do not need to be concerned about that. What they need to be concerned about is not actually Norfolk specific, but nationwide. And this is something that has been widely reported in the media, and even proclaimed and touted by FBI senior leadership itself, which is that personnel nationwide, including those who focus entirely on national security, have been pulled on a temporary or permanent basis from their normal duties to work on immigration enforcement operations. Now, like most of the federal government, personnel are a finite resource in the FBI. That's especially true given that Kash Patel recently acquiesced to another round of massive budget cuts. You know, we're not getting more people.
Which included cuts to the counterintelligence budget.
Correct. The counterintelligence budget and the counterterrorism budget, they're tricky things to delve into because the way that they're paid for by an open act of Congress is a little bit different than the rest of the Bureau. And the Bureau is required by law to keep certain staffing levels at a certain point. But I know they haven't addressed whether they're doing that or whether it's really been interrogated by the media. I suspect with all the changes that have happened at headquarters and the field offices, there are a lot of locations where what we call NIP funding, National Intelligence Program funding, is probably not being spent in the manner for which it is appropriated.
All these agents that are being pulled off counterintelligence and other investigations to do immigration enforcement, what are they doing? Are FBI agents making street arrests? Are they doing surveillance of suspected illegal migrants? What are these FBI agents doing?
So I haven't been in the FBI for 6 weeks, and this was a very fast-moving area even when I was there. So I don't want to make any definitive statements as to what they're currently focusing on. But what I saw across the nation were FBI agents doing perimeter security for immigration and customs enforcement operations and providing analytic support.
You do have
individuals who speak difficult to learn foreign languages, who possess in-depth cultural knowledge about foreign threats, who have decades of experience working incredibly complex national security matters, standing in a back alley in case somebody runs out of it.
What is the effect of that, Mike? When someone is pulled, it's not like pulling off an agent who's about to arrest somebody committing a bank robbery, for example.
Yeah.
Counterintelligence is a long and sophisticated cat and mouse game.
It's not uncommon for investigations to last years, if not a
right.
Day.
So is there an immediate effect on counterintelligence cases by pulling off these agents and throwing them into this deportation mixer?
There's going to be some immediate effect on individual cases.
How would that work?
The Bureau surges, right? Like, this isn't uncommon. After 9/11, a lot of things got put on the back burner for counterterrorism. Like, that's not the worry that there's going to be an immediate effect. The worry is that through a combination of driving out your most experienced executives, only assigning new agents to immigration and immigration-related violent crime, and making your senior agents focus on that, that our effectiveness, our knowledge, our expertise on national security threats is gradually going to diminish. And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to really measure what that looks like until it's too late.
Can you see, to make this more concrete, can you see such effects as an FBI counterintelligence agent, he has a source, a double agent inside Chinese intelligence, let's say, and suddenly he can't meet with the person. The agent, the informant says, I need an immediate meeting, I'm in danger, or I have really hot information for you about the theft of, you know, a document from the Navy command, let's say, saying, oh, I can't go to that meeting with my source because I got to do immigration duty?
I would hope that no supervisor, to be blunt, would be so idiotic as to allow that to happen. What concerns me more is that if an agent is detailed to do immigration operations, say for a week, and they're not regularly checking in to the office, or they're not regularly able to check into whatever comms plans they have with their assets, like, it's entirely foreseeable and possible that something like that may fall through the cracks.
Just to wrap up here and return to the subject that brought you here, it was clearly the new leadership's determination to root out anybody who had any role in the Russia investigation.
I think it's more expansive than that, but that's certainly part of it.
It's a big part of it. Now, you know, in recent days, we've had, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, you know, proclaim that the entire investigation was some sort of treasonous conspiracy to undermine President Trump. Clearly, that's, I think,
BS.
Jeff and I totally over the top. On the other hand, the FBI's performance does not look so good in retrospect. We've learned
I would push back against that, actually.
Let's do that. Yes.
If you look at the ultimate results of the various Russia investigations, starting with the Universe of Crossfire Hurricane cases,
right,
going up through the conclusion of the special counsel investigation, headed by Robert Mueller, and the publication of its report, you know, you have a lot of things in the public record that make it very clear there were seriously worrisome connections between members of the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and that the Russians were engaged in a massive social media disinformation campaign to affect.
I'm thinking off the top of my head, Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor.
The special counsel investigation alone had multiple convictions and guilty pleas of individuals for a wide variety of federal crimes. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence,
right,
at the time staffed by our now Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, issued an incredibly voluminous study that concluded time and time again that Russia was attempting to interfere with the 2016 election.
No, can I just say, no quarrel with that. Of course, the Russians were engaged in this unprecedented campaign to disrupt our election. But the FBI did screw up. The Carter Page FISA was an entirely botched effort that relied on the unverified Steele dossier. We've learned that Comey was pushing the Steele dossier into the intelligence assessment.
No. We have not learned that definitively.
Well,
we have a report issued by a current director of the CIA,
right,
who was viewed as too partisan to be appointed as the director of national intelligence by his own party the first time he was nominated. So I would caution people to take anything coming from John Ratcliffe or Tulsi Gabbard alleging any sort of conspiratorial behavior.
We had Sue Miller, the chief of CIA counterintelligence and a principal author of the intelligence assessment, on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. And she verified to us exactly what John Ratcliffe said, that Comey was pushing the Steele dossier so much so that if it wasn't included in the intelligence assessment, the FBI would remove its name from the document. It wouldn't have anything to do with it unless Comey got his way on the Steele dossier. Brennan brokered a compromise where it got put into a classified annex. But we now know the Steele dossier was essentially worthless, that none of the allegations in it that were not already in the public sphere have been verified. Most of them have been debunked. So the FBI did buy into a theory of the case.
But that
has not held up.
You've reported on the intelligence community long enough to know that disagreements between agencies and threats to dissent from official assessments, including removing one's seal or name, are far from uncommon. What we saw here was an incredibly tumultuous investigation with stakes unlike those ever seen in our nation's history. And of course, there were going to be disagreements.
But also screw ups. And I think any fair observer at this point reads the Horowitz report, reads the Durham report, looks at the evidence, listens to Sue Miller, would say, yeah, the FBI went too far here. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't an underlying investigation.
Do me a favor and refresh my memory. How many convictions resulted out of the Durham report?
The Durham report got no convictions, but the actual
out of his investigation.
And there were acquittals. Yeah, it was a botched effort.
It wasn't a botched effort. It was a botched effort because there was nothing there. Nobody is defending the Carter Page FISA.
Well, that was a biggie when you use the powers of FISA to target an American citizen.
There's no shame that there was some sort of massive conspiracy involving the FBI to undermine the foundations of democracy or abuse its power on behalf of a political party is quite frankly ludicrous and unsupported by the evidence. And as somebody who has studied this for his entire career, you should know this. You're picking at straws in individual events to defame an organization.
No, well, look, first of all, I started out by saying the treasonous conspiracy is complete bullshit. And I don't think it has any credibility to any of us who follow seriously the work of the FBI and the intelligence community. But on the other hand, I think we'll just have to disagree about whether the FBI's record here was stellar. Yes, they got a lot of convictions through Mueller, but there were screw-ups.
I'm not saying it was stellar. I'm just saying the portrait you're painting is not entirely accurate.
Well,
on that note, we will we'll let it stand.
Yeah, and I think the bottom line is that Russia did try to affect
absolutely
the 2016 elections.
By the way, Michael, I wrote a book about it, so I'm very well versed in what Russia and Putin did in the 2016 election. It was substantial, and it was deserving of a full investigation, no question.
And we don't want to get hung up forever on Comey's pushing to include the Steele dossier in the final Russia assessment, because the overall message gets lost. Trying to referee between you guys.
Fair enough.
That Russia did attempt to influence the elections, and that there were lots of disturbing connections between key Trump campaign officials and the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen a demonstration of President Trump, candidate Trump, first administration Trump, and current Trump's affection for Vladimir Putin, which has only slightly been, and even probably temporarily reversed lately, because as the president himself said, his wife pointed out that Putin may talk nice to him, but he's still bombing Kyiv every night. So right now we have a resumption of U.S. aid to Ukraine, and we hope that, from my point of view, I hope that sticks and that we continue to defend Ukraine with every possible means we can. But the Russians aren't going to give up, and they think they have a friend, albeit in a chaotic friend, in the White House. That's it. Michael Feinberg, thanks for spending your time with us. It's really great, and we wish you the best of luck with your wife's pregnancy and your new son.
You. Can I ask, what's next professionally? For you.
I'm going to be writing for Lawfare for some time, and I just joined the advisory committee of Justice Connection, which is a nonprofit that provides free legal representation and sort of logistical support to DOJ and FBI employees who find themselves politically targeted and driven out of the organizations.
Well, that's God's work.
Worthy endeavor.
Yeah.
Mike Feinberg, thanks again for being on the Spy Talk podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. MSW Media.